Welcome to the second season of the Fireside Podcast, presented by the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. I'm Chase Maxwell. Twenty-two years ago, the Friends began a storytelling series for adults. What could be better than sitting by the fire, sipping a warm cup of coffee or cider, while listening to some of the best writers Minnesota has to offer? Over the years, the Fireside series has featured a great range of authors, from Kate DiCamillo to Jack Weatherford, Carol Bly to Marlon James, making the winter just that much more bearable. The 2016 season continues this great legacy of presenting Minnesota's best authors reading by the fire. After a great response last year, we've decided to continue podcasting the series in its entirety. Author and journalist Rick Shevchik joins the series to discuss his behind-the-scenes, up-close-and-personal account of how a handful of Minnesota rock bands erupted out of a small Midwest market and made it big, including Augie Garcia and Bobby V to The Trashman and The Castaways. Through interviews with many of the key musicians, combined with extensive research and a phenomenal cachet of rare photographs, everybody's heard about The Bird reveals how this monumental era of Minnesota rock music in the 1960s evolved. Shevchik spent almost 30 years in daily journalism, mostly as a critic, reporter, and columnist for the Pioneer Press. He's the author of From Fields to Fairways, Classic Golf Clubs of Minnesota, among other nonfiction and fiction works, and has been in several working bands as a guitarist and singer.
Thanks, Baylor. And thanks so much for everybody turning out tonight. I appreciate that. I assume most of you are rock and roll lovers, at least remember what rock and roll used to be. And you've probably all heard about The Bird, I would assume. A little bit more about myself before I read a couple of passages from the book. I'm from Duluth. I did not grow up in the Twin Cities, but for those of you that did grow up in the Twin Cities and thought maybe that this was kind of a local phenomenon with all the bands that were popular back in the early to mid-60s, up in Duluth, we knew about it. It was happening up there, too. The bands that I wrote about were almost all based here in the Twin Cities. In fact, almost every one of them was sort of centered at a local high school. The Castaways were from Richfield. The Trashmen were mostly from Robbinsdale High School and Patrick Henry. The Underbeats were from North Minneapolis. They basically all had their local origins. But once they recorded records and got airplay on KDWB and WDGY, those records got played outside the Twin Cities too. My rock station in Duluth when I was growing up was WEBC. And when Surfin' Bird was a hit down here, it was a hit in Duluth. Same with The Grind by Gregory D and the Avantes. Same with Liar Liar by the Castaways. That was number one up in Duluth. The same time it was number one here. The same with Run, Run, Run by The Gestures, a number one song in the Twin Cities. That was a huge hit in Duluth. And just a personal aside, my older brother Mark was a drummer at a band called The Soul Seekers in Duluth, and that was part of what drew me into being really interested in this music as I was growing up. I was born in 1952, so when Surfin' Bird was a hit, I was about 12 years old. But my brother had already been in a band for a couple of years as a drummer, and later on his band got very popular in Duluth. They had a couple of top 10 hits in Duluth. And then I subsequently started a band with some of my high school buddies. So the whole 60s era for me was pretty much about rock and roll. And the beauty of Minnesota rock and roll is that those songs that came out of the Twin Cities, that came out of K-Bank Studio, that were on the Soma record label, were being played in the same rotation all over the state, along with the British Invasion songs, along with Motown songs, along with the Beach Boys. They had just dropped them in, and as far as we were concerned, that was all part of the pattern of the sound of the 60s. And that's sort of what I tried to capture in this book. I'm gonna set up the introduction of the book by briefly talking about how the Trash Men got to be as popular as they were. It basically started with a recording studio called K-Bank, which is still in existence, but it's now called Creation Audio. It's over at by the Black Forest in Minneapolis, Black Forest Restaurant. And a couple of radio stations, KDWB and WDGY, that were competing very heavily for the teen listeners back in the early 60s. And a record label called Soma Records, which was owned by the Heiliker brothers, Amos and Dan. And if you were not aware, Soma was Amos's name spelled backwards. And he was a bit of an egomaniac, I guess you could say. But when the Heilikers bought a piece of K-Bank recording studio in the 50s, and when they started up their record label in 1954, they were never thinking about rock and roll. They weren't thinking about the youth audience. They weren't thinking about teenagers at all. It was they were much more interested in their core business, which was rack jobbing, which was providing records to the record stores around the area. And eventually they started the Musicland record store chain, and that's how they became extremely rich. They ended up selling that chain in the late 60s, but they were extremely successful businessmen. And the Soma record label was really kind of a sidelight for them. It wasn't anything that they spent a lot of time thinking about in the 50s. Most of the songs that came out on Soma back in the 50s were polka records or old-time dance records. In some cases, there'd be some jazz. It was almost a what you would call a vanity label, because a band or an artist would come in with $500 and record two sides, and then Soma would press that record and give you 500 copies of it, and they would send out a couple of copies of it to various radio stations and record stores in case anybody was interested, but generally that didn't happen. Those records weren't made to sell or to get airplay. They were there so the bands that made them, the polka bands in most cases, would have something to give away at their dances. And it wasn't until Bobby V came from North Dakota in the spring of 1959 and recorded a song called Susie Baby at K-Bank and turned it out on the Soma label that there was a successful rock and roll record that was recorded in the Twin Cities. Augie Garcia had made a couple of records on a label called North Star out of St. Paul before that, but they really didn't sell a lot and they didn't get a whole lot of airplay. But Susie Baby was a hit. It got to number one in the Twin Cities, and the Liberty record label from Los Angeles quickly snapped up Bobby V's contract from Soma. And again, the Heilikers didn't think a whole lot of it. They didn't think that that a rock and roll singer was going to have any kind of longevity. So they figured they'd make a quick buck and sell Bobby V. And of course, Bobby V went on to have a terrific 5-year run with a lot of number one records. The Heilikers again had some success with Mule Skinner Blues in 1960 with a band out of Wisconsin called the Fendermen. And in 1963, they had another hit with Dave Dudley with a country record called 6 Days on the Road. So now they're starting to see that there might be a little bit of money in this pop music thing that they're working with. And at that point, the Trash Men come along. And they were one of the many working bands in the Twin Cities. They'd been successful, but they had tried recording once before. They'd done a recording in their living room that they'd put out on a record, and it wasn't very successful. They got a couple of spins on some of the local stations, but it flopped pretty quickly. So they're becoming more popular, and they've adapted a surf sound to their regular kind of rock and roll, rockabilly, R&B mix that they were playing, which most people were playing around here. Most of the bands were playing the same kind of material. But they went out to California in the fall of 1962 to listen to surf music, and they came back with a different sound, more of a reverb guitar sound, more like a bit like what Duane Eddy had been doing, but it was more Dick Dale and the Deltones kind of a sound. And then the Beach Boys had become real popular in early 63 with their surf music. So now the Trash Men were a little bit out in front of the pack. All they needed was a song. They were looking for something to record. And one night they were at a Wisconsin bar called Woodley's Country Dam in Amory, Wisconsin, which was a magnet for Twin Cities kids because beer was sold to kids who were only 18 years old in Wisconsin. And they didn't look too closely at fake IDs either, so Woodley's was always jumping on the weekends. And the Trashmen used to play out there a lot, and even some weekends when they weren't playing, they would just go out and hang out there. And one weekend, there was a band from California called the Sorensen Brothers who were playing, and they played a medley of two songs called Papa Umau Mau and The Bird is the Word. And those songs had been hits in Los Angeles for a band called the Rivingtons, but they never made the charts in the Twin Cities. The Trashmen had never heard it before, never heard either of those songs before. The kids up at Woodley's Country Dam had never heard it before. The Trashmen's drummer, Steve Warrer, listened to this medley by the Sorensen Brothers and thought, boy, that would really sound good in our set, but it would sound even better if I did kind of a goofy voice to it. So if you can remember what Surfin' Bird actually sounded like when Steve sang it, he dropped his voice to a real low register and kind of growled out the lyrics and then did some crazy breath control stuff in between where the two songs join. And what he told the band that night was, well, the first time they played it, he says, I'm just going to drum along and sing, and then when it's time to change the chord, I'll just kind of give you a nod. It's a two-chord song. So he nodded at him, and then they would change the chord. And then he said, in the middle of the song, I'm just going to stop it completely, and I'm going to get a breath. I'm going to just spurt out some nonsense gibberish. And then once I got my breath back, we'll go into the second part of the medley, and then you guys just start playing again. So that was it. That was really the birth of that record. The first night they played it at Chubb's Ballroom, it went over really big with the kids who were there. Bill Deal was the MC that night. Bill Deal of WDGY, the Wizard of the Wax, the Rajah of the Records, the Purveyor of the Platters. Bill was ubiquitous in those years. He MC'd just about... every weekend he was out doing something. He sometimes did three shows a night. He would start out in Bloomington and then go out to Big Reggie's Dance Land in Excelsior, and then he'd drive to Wisconsin to do another MC job over there. So everybody was really familiar with Bill. He'd give records away and he would MC and he'd just kind of keep the mood light. But this night at Chubb's Ballroom, when the Trashmen played Surfin' Bird, they ended up having to play it four or five times because the kids loved it so much. And at the end of the show, Bill Deal says, you guys got to record that. Now, they'd been looking for something to record, but they were looking for something kind of normal. they'd never thought of this as a single. But when Bill Deal, the most popular DJ in the state, tells you you should put that on the record because it could be a hit, then you listen. So they cut a preliminary version of it. It went about 3.5 minutes, and they did it in the basement studio of a record store called Nickel Lake Records over at Nicollet and Lake in Minneapolis, which was owned by a man named George Garrett. And Garrett had been somewhat of a producer, mostly working on country records. He'd actually worked with Dave Dudley in the past. But the Trashmen didn't know who he was, and he didn't know who they were. But they went to his basement studio and they cut an early version of Surfin' Bird, and they took the tape to Bill Deal and said, what do you think? And Deal said, you know, this could sound better. You could do a better job on it, and you have to cut a minute out of this, because at 3.5 minutes, it was a minute longer than any radio station was going to play. And he said, you should go over to K-Bank and do this because I got better facilities. So they did that. Dal Winslow, the rhythm guitar player of the Trashmen, borrowed the $500 from his mother, and they went over to K-Bank Studio, recorded another version, shorter version, brought the acetate to Bill Deal, and Bill put it on the air that night in a sort of a battle of the new songs that they would do every night. And Surfin' Bird won, going away. The kids called up, loved it. The Trashmen got ecstatic. They realized that they might actually have a hit on their hands. And George Garrett then gets a call the next morning from Amos Heiliker and said, George, I'm hearing a lot about a song called Surfin' Bird by a band called the Trashmen. Do you know anything about them? Well, when the first acetate was made in George's studio, his engineer came up and George had said, got anything here? Is this any good? And the engineer said, nope, same old shit. So obviously George didn't think a whole lot of it until Amos Heiliker calls him, and when Amos says, do you know anything about this band? George said, yep, I'm managing them, they're my band. And the Trashmen didn't know that at the time, but that's pretty much how things worked out. George Garrett became their manager. He signed them to Soma Records, but their first single actually came out on a label called Garrett, which was created by George Garrett. And the single is released in the fall of 1963, and it sold 38,000 copies in the first week of release. It was an absolute smash. Went rocketing up the charts in Minnesota. It was number one for months here. And by December, it was starting to catch on nationally. And by January, it was number four in the country. This is the last week of January, 1964. And WDGY was sponsoring the Winter Carnival Spectacular at the St. Paul Auditorium that weekend, and the Trashmen were headlining. And that's where my book starts, and I'd like to read about what that atmosphere was like the night that the Trashmen were playing at the WDGY Winter Carnival Spectacular. The Trashmen, Tony Andreessen, Bob Reed, Steve Warr, and Dal Winslow, looked around in amazement as they were escorted on stage by police at the 1964 WDGY Winter Carnival Spectacular. The dance floor of the old St. Paul Auditorium was, quote, a swirling mass of teenagers, unquote, as the Pioneer Press would describe it in the next morning's edition. But there really wasn't room to dance. Girls were screaming at the band, and those closest to the stage were clutching and tearing at the pants legs of the Trashmen's matching suits. Guys were yelling, pushing, and throwing punches. Police heard reports of a stabbing, but could not confirm it. The band members heard a rumor that someone with a rifle had been removed from the auditorium's balcony, but the noise from the crowd was so deafening that they would never have heard a shot if it had been fired. The Trashmen could barely even hear themselves once they started to play. Jan and Dean, the bushy-haired, striped-shirted surfer dudes from Los Angeles who had scored the number one Billboard hit Surf City just the previous summer, had opened for the Trashmen and hadn't been very happy about it. They'd been preceded by Clyde McFatter, the former lead singer of the Drifters, who had racked up several top 10 hits of his own, Linda Scott, whose I've Told Every Little Star had reached number three in 1961, Joey Powers, who had made the top 10 the previous month with Midnight Mary, and several local groups, including the popular Mike Wagner and the Bops, and a promising outfit called the Underbeats. But all that had been a precursor to what was amounting to the real coronation of the 1964 St. Paul Winter Carnival, the Trashmen accepting their crowns as the kings of rock and roll, and not just in the Twin Cities or the state of Minnesota or even the five-state area, including the Dakotas, Iowa, and Wisconsin. In a few days, the band would be heading to the West Coast as headliners on its first national tour. The Trashmen had already made one trip to the West Coast as unknowns, a pilgrimage a year earlier to learn about the surf sound that was sweeping the nation. They learned well. Their massive hit single, Surfin' Bird, had been number one on both the local WDGY and KDWB charts for weeks and was sitting at the number four spot nationally. Disc jockey Bill Deal, who was emceeing the Winter Carnival concert, had sources telling him that Surfin' Bird would jump to number one when the new Billboard chart came out the next day. The Rococo-styled auditorium, which was built in 1906 and had been expanded in 1931 to 16,000 seats to accommodate auto shows, hockey games, and circuses, was still not big enough to hold everyone who tried to jam into the building on that cold Friday night. Although the teens came and went during the 6 hours of music, the police estimated that 17,000 were inside when the doors were closed and the Trashmen hit the stage at 11 p.m., while another 6,000 milled outside. 8 years earlier, Elvis Presley had drawn just 3,000 for his first Twin Cities appearance in the building. It was insane, it really was, Andreessen said 50 years later. The images of that night still burn vividly in his mind. We were doing the show and a girl grabs my leg. The boots we wore had zippers down the side and they weren't very tight on me. She unzipped that and had that boot off me so fast and I never got it back. So I took off the other one and threw it out into the crowd. It was crazy, recalled rhythm guitar player Winslow. It was just a sea of people in that auditorium. I'm sure you couldn't hear. We couldn't hear anything we were singing. Andreessen said, they were screaming so loud that I don't know if they could really even hear us play. They didn't play for long. Unlike the four-hour marathon jobs the band had played so many times at Minnesota's teen clubs, ballrooms, and roller rinks on their way up the rock and roll ladder, this package show required them to play just a half a dozen numbers, which included King of the Surf, the hastily composed B-side to Surfin' Bird that had turned into a hit on its own, a preview of their new single, Bird Dance Beat, allegedly written by their manager, George Garrett, and a couple of surf songs from their forthcoming album. It was all received with ear-damaging approval, but the loudest roar erupted when the diminutive, blonde-haired Warrer, the group's drummer and lead singer, put his mouth against the microphone, lowered his voice to a menacing growl, and barked, "Well, everybody's heard about the bird." In an era of unselfconscious rock and roll and good time party songs, the Trash Men had hit pay dirt with perhaps the goofiest blast of adrenaline-charged nonsense in rock history. Surfin' Bird had made the Twin Cities charts a couple of weeks before President John F. Kennedy's assassination and first cracked the Billboard Hot 100 on December 7, 1963. Despite, or perhaps because of, the nation's somber mood, the Papa Umau Mau refrain of Surfin' Bird had been embraced by the ascendant baby boom generation as a happy, mindless mantra. The Beatles, unknown in America a month earlier, were looming on the horizon, scheduled to make their first U.S. visit in February. During that month, the former Hibbing, Minnesota rock and roll piano player, now playing folk guitar under the name Bob Dylan, would start writing a song called Mr. Tambourine Man. Though the Beatles and Dylan would have an enormous impact on the Trash Men's future, their present could not have looked brighter. They would work nearly nonstop for the next 3 years, playing the surf clubs in Southern California, the frat parties at Columbia and Cornell, and seemingly every dance hall and rock and roll joint in between. In the meantime, by 1965, estimates ranged from 350 to 500 Minnesota rock bands playing teen dances across the state. The members of the most successful of these bands made more money per week than their fathers did and drove Corvettes, Jaguars, and Thunderbirds. By the time the Trash Men decided to call it quits in 1967, they had seen the music scene change in unimaginable ways, and they had seen their own audience stop dancing. Upper Midwest music fans began gravitating toward the bands that had been encouraged by the Trash Men's success, but took their musical inspiration from the Beatles and Bob Dylan. The irony was that the Beatles and Dylan had idolized the same rock and roll pioneers, Buddy Holly, Jerry Lee Lewis, the Everly Brothers, Little Richard, Chuck Berry, who had inspired the Trash Men. Yet the Trash Men were content to stay close to the roots of rock and roll rather than attempt to reinvent it. That faithfulness cost them their audience in the mid-60s, but it also set them up for a lucrative comeback decades later. The success of the Trash Men in the 1960s cannot be overstated. They showed countless Minnesota musicians that four guys from flyover land could put a band together, cut a record, get airplay, and become stars for however long it lasted. They also demonstrated the limitations of trying to launch a music career away from the coasts. Quote, "There could have been 50 hits out of that town with the right producers," said Owen Husney, who played in the High Spirits, a mid-60s band from St. Louis Park, and later became Prince's first manager. This is the story of those 1960s era Minnesota bands and how close some of them came to achieving the ultimate rock and roll dream. So the Trash Men really set things up for a lot of the bands to come. But one thing to keep in mind is, as important as the Beatles were, not only in Minnesota, but of course all over the country, most of the bands in Minnesota that had huge success in this era had already started before the Beatles were ever heard of in the United States. The Castaways got started in about 1962. The Gestures, about that same time, 62. The Underbeats, 61, 62, about the same time that the Trash Men started. All of these bands and a number of other ones had already put together really successful acts and were thriving in the teen dance club scene here in Minnesota before anybody had ever heard of the Beatles. What happened, though, was that when the Beatles arrived, it became fairly obvious fairly soon that the bands that were going to survive in the next year or two were going to have to adapt to this new sound. And some of them were more successful than others. As I pointed out in that introduction, the Trash Men were not that enthusiastic about trying to change their sound and compete with the new directions that the Beatles were leading the music into. They cut a few singles that had some more modern stylistic wrinkles to them. And in fact, Tony Andreessen became a bit taken with Bob Dylan for a while and wrote a couple of songs that really did sound somewhat like Bob Dylan. I think they're good songs, but the public really just wasn't interested in hearing the Trashmen do that kind of material. But the bands that followed the Trashmen really were quite a bit more successful in changing their style, both in terms of music, but also in appearance. One of the things that you'll notice as you read and look at this book is that up through about 1962 or so, styles of dress with musicians really hadn't changed a whole lot. Most of the bands, including the Trashmen, would wear coats and ties, nicely ironed white shirts and matching pants. Nothing too fancy, maybe a different colored vest or something like that, but mostly they dressed up to be on stage. But then by 63, when surf music came in, a bit more casual style was seen. You know, the Beach Boys would wear short-sleeved striped shirts, and some of the local bands would experiment with that. Then the Beatles come along, and now it's more of a mod look, Carnaby Street. Just another year or two later, then we're talking about more of a psychedelic look. You know, you're getting bands who are wearing paisleys and bell bottoms and polka dots and basically whatever they could think of that would look a little outrageous. But this had come in by 1967, so you're really looking at a 5-year period where styles of dress and music and even expression had just changed enormously and was constantly changing. That's one of the things that I remember so well from those years, and I think, you know, looks like most of us lived through that. It was really a time of dizzying change. One of the bands that was most successful at adapting was the Castaways. As I mentioned before, the Castaways were from Richfield, and they started out they were playing pizza joints pretty much in their own backyard. And one of the better known musicians in the Twin Cities today is Lonnie Knight. Lonnie is still out playing. He plays in White Bear Lake fairly often. He's got some guys that he will still play with on occasion. Sometimes he plays solo, he plays electric guitar, he plays acoustic. Very talented guy. He's been a musician his whole life. Well, he was originally in the Castaways. He was one of the original members of the Castaways, but they split up into two groups, essentially, and Lonnie ended up in a group called the Ravons, while the rest of the Castaways picked up a guitar player named Bob Falshaw and continued on as the Castaways. And then they added a keyboard player named Jim Donna, and that made them a 5-piece group. One day at a practice, and now this was in probably late 64, maybe early into 1965, they were already growing their hair out. They were starting to play the sort of songs that the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Dave Clark Five, more of that style of music. And Jim Donna's sitting at his parents' organ in their living room. And he comes up with a lick that has this kind of nice couple of chord changes in it. And Danny Craswell, the drummer, comes over because they're going to have a practice in a few minutes. And he listens to that and he says, "Hey, I really like that. Let me see if I can throw out some rhyming lines there and we can fit that into a song." So he throws out "Liar, Liar," "Pants on Fire," "Your Nose is Longer Than a Telephone Wire." And they just kind of keep riffing off of that, kind of a kiddie rhyme. But within about a half an hour, they had a song, and they take it downstairs where the rest of the band has gathered, getting ready to practice, and they teach the parts to the band, and it takes another hour, and they've got a song that they want to record. They're pretty sure that this is going to be the one that's going to be a hit for them. And they had two lead vocals on it. One was the high falsetto part, and the other was the lower regular voice part that you'd hear in the chorus, or in the regular verse. And they had, usually Roy Hensley and Bob Falshaw did the vocals on that, or they would split the vocals, on whatever songs they were singing. But in this case, they had Dick Robey, their bass player, sing the low part. Denny Craswell told me as I was doing the research for the book, that was just kind of a spontaneous decision they made as they're going into the studio because they thought Robey's voice was just right for that particular song. They weren't going to make him the lead singer, but they wanted him to do that lead on that particular song. So they go into K-Bank studio and they record this for Soma Records, and it gets released locally, and it jumps to the top of the charts. By midsummer 1965, Liar Liar is number one in the Twin Cities. I don't remember for sure if it was number one in Duluth, but it certainly did very well. Everybody heard it all summer long. And I'm going to read one more section about what happened to the castaways that summer, because this is something that I learned as I was doing the book. When I interviewed Tony Andreessen about the Trashmen, he said, you should talk to the castaways, because I think they had something was kind of going on in that band, a bit of dissension, and he didn't really know what the whole story was, and I'd never heard this before, but I found out that they had, in the summer of 1965, as their song is hitting number one, they had a lot going on in the band. I'm quoting Bob Falshaw now, the lead guitar player of the Castaways. Things were going a little nuts, and at the time you could say our bass player Dick Robey was going a little nuts. The Castaways were playing a job at Mr. Lucky's on a Friday night while Liar Liar was at its local peak and the band members were feeling like celebrities. In the middle of a song, Robey stepped on his cord and pulled it out of his Mosrite bass. Some of the kids leaning against the stage saw Robey's bass get unplugged and started laughing and pointing. It happened twice more that night, and in frustration, Robey threw his bass onto the stage floor and the neck snapped off the body. The band took a break while Donna called Jim Lopez at B-sharp and asked to have a replacement bass sent to Mr. Lucky's. Falshaw says, the place is packed, we're waiting, and I'm looking at the busted guitar. I pick it up. It's my nature to think, well, if we get a little baling wire and duct tape, maybe we can fix it. Dick sees me messing with his guitar, which I shouldn't have done, and he comes out and says, I'm going to hit you, which he did. He smacks me, a sucker punch, and now I'm fighting back. The two wrestled on stage, knocking over a mic that started feeding back as security guards ran up to the stage and separated the bandmates. Once backstage, Robey and Falshaw were assigned fines of $25 each by the rest of the band. Falshaw apologized, they shook hands, a new bass arrived, and the Castaways returned to the stage to finish their gig. The band played again on Saturday night with no incident. On Sunday night, they had another gig. Everyone was going to ride together in the band's hearse, which had very little room for all five band members and their equipment. When they got to Robey's house that afternoon, Jim Donna brought the broken bass and its case inside to clear a little more space. Falshaw said, I was driving the hearse. We hadn't picked up Denny yet. Jim goes to Robey's door and says, here's your bass, Dick. I didn't think he said much else. Dick goes berserk, does a sucker punch karate thing on Jim's mouth, and knocks some teeth out. The next thing I see, Jim has a handkerchief up to his mouth, spitting blood. Dick's dad is holding him at the door because he wants to tear into Jim. Robey concurred with Falshaw's account of the incident with some additional detail. I punched him out, Robey said. I had a habit of punching people out when I was about 19. It was my bad. I allowed a situation to develop that could have been avoided, but I let it go to the point where Jim got me into a lot of trouble with my folks. Robey said it was the weekend of his high school graduation and his whole family was sitting around the table when Donna arrived with the broken bass, which Robey's father had bought for him. Jim, you outed me, you son of a bitch, Robey said. It was like he was telling on me. I got mad and smacked him in the head, knocked him out. He bled all over my folks' living room carpet. He had to get oral surgery. I guess I threw quite a scare into him. I didn't see him for quite a while after that. Falshaw said in hindsight that he believed Robey was having a meltdown. At the time, he wasn't aware of Robey's embarrassment over the broken bass, but he, Donna, and Hensley decided on the spot that Robey was out of the band. We go over to Denny's house nearby and tell him what happened, Falshaw said. Next to Denny's house lives a dentist who did a quick fix to Jim's mouth so we could play the gig. Roy, who played rhythm, said he always wanted to play bass. We decided we don't need a rhythm guitar. Dick is out. Jim, Denny, Roy, and myself were the castaways. When the record hit big nationally, when we went out to California, it was the four of us without Dick. Jim Donna said, it was unfortunate that Dick left the band. Bands have fallings out sometimes. He left the band and we became a four-piece very suddenly. I said, Roy, you're going to be our new bass player. Start practicing. We were on the way to a gig that very day. It was quite an adjustment. This was when we were still playing locally. It was just as the record was breaking in the Twin Cities. It would soon be breaking big everywhere. Unbeknownst to the castaways, Liar Liar was racing up the charts and markets all over the United States in the summer of 1965. Meanwhile, however, the band is going about its business, trying to get used to playing as a four-piece. So Dick is out of the group, Falshaw said. He had issues. I remember we played at the Cato Ballroom and Dick Robey was at the gig in the audience being a nice guy. He was the old Dick, no problem. He wanted a ride back to the Twin Cities. At the time, Jim and Roy and Danny all had previous plans, so I had to drive the hearse back. I said, I'll give you a ride. That's when the gun incident happened. The remaining castaways had heard rumors from other musicians that Robey was pissed off at them. Understandable, Falshaw said, since Liar Liar was becoming a smash. Robey was asking to be paid his share of the royalties for the record, even though the rest of the band hadn't seen any. There were even rumors that Robey wanted to kill the castaways, rumors that Falshaw dismissed until Robey pulled out a gun on the drive home from Mankato and started shooting at highway signs in the middle of the night. You're in a vehicle hearing that first shot go off and you kind of pee a little bit, Falshaw said. Now I'm fast talking to Robey and we're just talking about whatever, I can't remember, but keep talking, Bob, keep talking. Pretty soon we're at his house, I drop him off and say, okay, Dick, see ya, I go home and change my underwear. The scope of the success of Liar Liar was revealed to the castaways toward the end of the summer when they were summoned to a meeting with Ira Heiliker at Soma Records. When the band walked in, they saw a large table covered with record charts from all over the country and even overseas. Each chart indicated that Liar Liar was a big hit in that particular market. We were totally astounded, Craswell said. We knew it was number one on Ouija, but we didn't know it was number one in Holland and all over the place. We didn't know unless Jim knew and didn't tell us. Ira Heiliker, their manager, said, you guys got a tour. You got to chase this down. Your record's going to be number one next week in Hollywood, California. And you're up there playing International Falls in all these crazy places. So what the castaways ended up doing was going out to California as a four-piece and lip-syncing the lead vocal. Bob Falshaw lip-synced Robey's lead vocal. So when you see these, you can go on YouTube and see some of the TV shows that the castaways were on. They have adjusted to filling in for the absent Dick Robey by lip-syncing his vocals with having somebody else do it. And it was a very successful tour for them. They actually were in a movie that summer out in California called It's a Bikini World. Yeah. It's not a good movie, but considering they're just a bunch of guys from Minneapolis a couple of weeks earlier, and then now they're in a movie with Deborah Wally and Eric Burdon and the Animals, that was a pretty fast rise for them. They played some concerts on the West Coast and ended up coming back to Minnesota around the 1st of September. But they were so successful out there that the TV shows they appeared on asked them to come back, and they got booked to do a couple of more shows. But now it's getting to be mid-late September, and the problem was that Danny Craswell is still a senior in high school, so the rest of the band had to go to the principal's office and beg to get him out of high school for enough time that they could go back to California and support their record. Their follow-up record was a song called So Long, Babe, which was kind of emblematic of what happened to the castaways after that record was released. It was pretty much of a flop, and within another 6 months, Jim Donna decided that he'd really be better off going to college, so he left the band, and Bob Falshaw got drafted, and he went to Vietnam. And that was what happened to a lot of bands in the mid-60s. The castaways were continued to be booked by Jim Donna, even though Jim was not in the band anymore. He was going to college. But he recruited a couple of other players to take his place and Bob Falshaw's place, including Greg Maland, who was the Greg of Gregory D and the Avantes, who had a big hit with a song called The Grind. But that band had broken up, and so Greg Maland ended up playing keyboards with the castaways for a while. And they lasted another couple of years and probably came to an end about the same time that the Trashmen did, about 1967. And the Gestures, who had a big hit out of Mankato called Run, Run, Run in 1964, lasted a few years But by 67, they had broken up too. So that was pretty much what happened to most of the early bands in the Twin Cities. Styles of music changed, life came along, the draft affected a lot of the bands. In some cases, marriage or family, college. The only one that really sustained itself from the beginning of this era to the end was the Underbeats. And some of you may recall that the Underbeats ended up moving to Los Angeles in 1968 and changing their name to Gypsy, and recorded four albums in Los Angeles under that name before they broke up. So that's pretty much the story that I tell here, with a lot of other side trips and mentions of other bands. But that was kind of the arc of the rock and roll scene in Minnesota, that they started out with very humble beginnings, without great ambitions of going anywhere, and some of them ended up kind of getting lucky, catching the brass ring for a little while, having national chart success with one song, but none of them were able to sustain it very long. The Underbeats went the farthest, but they all ended up back in Minnesota eventually.
We've reached one of the best parts of the Fireside series, the Q&A with the author and our dedicated audience at Hamlin Midway Library. It's a chance to go beyond the book, connecting readers and writers on a deeper level. To make it easier for you, the listener, I've summarized the questions and we'll read them. First up, an audience member inquires about members of the Trash Man after the band broke up. Where are they now?
Well, that's a really good question. Dal was a banker for the rest of his professional years. Bob Reed had a couple of management jobs with some manufacturing companies. And Tony Andreessen went into financial management and ended up a millionaire. Yeah, and Tony is still playing all the time. He'll sit in with other bands playing his great style of surf guitar. And he also plays with a bluegrass band that probably plays about 20 or 30 gigs every summer. They're called the Platte River Boys, I think is the name. Is that
okay.
Platte Valley? Excuse me. And he's just a phenomenal musician, and fortunately he's comfortable enough that he can afford to play whenever he wants to.
Next up, an audience member asked Chef Chick about the contributions of female musicians during this era and the impact they had upon 60s rock and roll in Minnesota.
Yeah, actually, my brother's band, the Soul Seekers in Duluth, had a woman singer named Bonnie Matheson, which set them apart, and I think was one of the reasons why their band was as successful as they were. Their first single, Boom Boom, was it made the KDWB charts for 1 week. But you're right, when you look around and see all of these bands from the Twin Cities, now, they weren't all white, and I did write about some of the mixed-race bands in here. You had Michael's Mystics, you had Dave Brady and the Stars, several other ones, but the women just didn't seem to crack the consciousness of these musicians that were putting the bands together. There were a couple of all-women bands. There was the 19th Amendment with Susie Mork, and I tried very hard to get a hold of her. I know she's living out in Colorado right now. I sent her a number of messages. I wanted to talk to her about her experiences, but I assume she got the messages and just chose not to talk about it. There was also a band out of Fulda, Minnesota called the cool name. You all know Patrick Royce of the Star Tribune. Well, he talks about them a lot because they're from his hometown. And I've got the two records that they recorded, and they're really kind of fun, but they didn't go anywhere. And there were a couple of other ones. Warren Kendrick, the producer of The Electras and The Litter, wrote a couple of songs for a woman singer who, again, is mentioned in here, but her name is escaping me right now. But those songs didn't go anywhere. When I set about to do this book, my primary goal was to write about the bands that had made records that were successful enough that people still remember these bands because they know the songs. And in telling the stories of those specific bands, whenever there was sort of crossbreeding with other groups, or if one of them left to go to another band, or they took somebody from another band, or they were friends with other bands, if it seemed like it helped further the story about the core bands that I wrote about, I would write about these other groups. And again, the female rock and rollers just didn't come up in my research. There just wasn't a whole lot to talk about them.
Following that question, an audience member asked about the origins of the name Soma. Was it inspired by Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, where a similar term appears?
It is. Somebody would know that the book it comes from. Is it a Ray Bradbury book? Brave New World, yes. That's where it's from. Yeah, I read that when I was a younger man. But that Soma Records had no relation to that. It, you know, you'd think that that might have been a cool reason to name a label Soma, but Amos never had heard of Ray Bradbury. of Aldous Huxley, right.
Next up, an audience member asked Chef Chick to expand upon the difficulties experienced by mixed race bands in 60s Minnesota. What sort of discrimination did these bands face?
Yes, it was true. Butch Stokes, in particular, one of the two brothers who founded the Mystics, said that when they played ballrooms outside of the metro area, in some cases, he felt like they might have been the first mixed race people that they'd ever seen there. In most cases, I was never told of any violence that ever happened to any of these bands, but it was occasionally an uncomfortable situation. They could tell that they were a novelty in the areas that they were playing. And he also said that there were some clubs that just didn't hire black or mixed race bands, and there were also black clubs that didn't hire white bands. It was kind of like you knew who you were trying to draw into your club, you knew who would come to your club, and Mr. Lucky's, for instance, was not a place that worried at all about who the clientele was. They would book the Mystics, they would book Dave Brady and the Stars. They didn't care. You know, you're in the heart of Minneapolis, and whoever showed up would be great. But I think as you got a little bit out onto the fringes, I think that's when you started to see a little bit more of the segregation in the clubs and with the bands.
Following that question, Chef Chick discusses some of his favorite bands from the era.
Let's put it this way. I have a favorite. I want to mention two, to tell you the truth. Dale Menton of The Gestures, to me, has always been probably the most significant musical figure in terms of his creativity. I think Run, Run, Run is as good a rock and roll song as any band in America recorded in the 60s. Every time it comes on, I still get that same jolt of excitement. The drumming is great, the harmonies are great, the tempo. And it's an interesting story about that record, too. Lou Regert, who later became Lou Waters on CNN News, was a DJ at KDWB, and he got a copy of that tape when the Gestures were hoping to record Run, Run, Run. And he met them in the studio, and he said, I think you guys have got a really good song here, but if you double up the pace of the bass drumming on the refrain, I think it'd be a lot more successful. And that's a huge part of that record. I don't think Dale has a tape of what it sounded like before they did it that way, but I can't imagine it without it. So Lou Regert made a big contribution to what, like I said, I think is one of the great records of the 60s. And Dale Menton wrote a lot of great songs, but he couldn't stand the road. He hated touring with the Gestures. He was a little older than the rest of the guys, in some cases a lot older. And the parents of the rest of the guys kind of relied on him to be a babysitter for the rest of the band. And he had to go through their luggage every night and looking for Jack Daniels bottles and pouring it out. And then the band members hated him for doing it. And he didn't want to have to do it, but it was the only way to keep the guys on the road. So he quit the band fairly early. He was only with them about a year and a half after Run, Run, Run was a success. But he went into music production, songwriting, and he's still active in the music business today. He's been in the Twin Cities ever since. He's probably written a lot of radio and TV ads that you can recall over the last 30 or 40 years. And he's just a great guy. And the Gestures have reunited. Two of them are dead now, unfortunately, but he and Tom Kluger, the bass player, have added two more members, and they're starting to play fairly frequently. And if you ever get a chance to see the Gestures, I recommend it. The other figure that really is remarkable to me, and he's a central character in the book, and I didn't even know he existed before I started writing it, is Rico Rosenbaum. Rico's from St. Paul, and went to Highland Park, joined a band called the Escapades, who wore human hair beetle wigs in early 1965, and passed themselves off as a British band. They even faked the accents. They did that for 3 or 4 months before people finally caught on to them. And the band only lasted about 9 months, and the reason they broke up was that Jim Johnson, the leader of the Underbeats, was so taken with Rico Rosenbaum's looks, singing, and guitar playing, that he said, I've got to get this guy into my band. So he essentially poached him from the Escapades, and the Escapades fell apart. And Jim also picked up drummer Tom Nystrom from the Accents, which essentially finished off the Accents too. And he creates the super band for himself. Now, this is the core of the band that ended up becoming Gypsy. And once they turned into Gypsy, Rico Rosenbaum's songwriting had become stronger and stronger. The last few singles that they turned out as the Underbeats were written by Rico, and they were just phenomenal songs, just great, great pieces of music. But they didn't go anywhere in the Twin Cities. There was no promotional push. They had no production. The band just realized that it was a dead end here, and it was so much harder to get airplay by 1967 than it had been in 1964 and 5, because now the radio stations were being controlled by corporate offices that were telling them what you could play. All of a sudden, these loose playlists where a kid could, the band could record a song at K-Bank and get it pressed on Soma and bring it to a DJ and say, could you listen to my record? And if the DJ liked it, he'd play it on the air that night. Well, those days were over by 67. There might have been 2 or 3 records all year from local bands that made any impact at that point. So that's essentially why the Underbeats felt they had to leave town. When they get to Los Angeles and they start recording albums, Rico Rosenbaum wrote almost every track for their 4 albums as Gypsy, and he was a phenomenal songwriter. Unfortunately, he came to a sad end. He got involved in drugs and committed suicide in 1978.
Building off that last question, is there another era in Minnesota music history that attracts Shefchik and would be worthy of a follow-up book to Everybody's Heard About the Bird?
Well, the next era would be the 70s. I was a huge fan of punk and new wave music in the 70s. That was sort of right after I was out of college and maybe getting a little bit too old for doing the pogo, but I loved a lot of those bands. But there's 2 books now being prepared, one by the Historical Society and the other by the U of M Press. One is it's based around the bands that were popular at First Avenue, and another one is more about the Minneapolis sound of the 70s, which would include Prince and also take in the hipsters and Husker Du and, into the 80s with the Replacements. So that era is going to be covered really well by 2 other authors, and I'm more than happy to let them take off on that one.
Finally, an audience member asks about the band Danny's Reasons. It wasn't included in the narrative, but will be included in Shefchik's new foreword to the second printing of the book. Can you talk a bit more about them?
Danny's, that's one of the reasons that I'm doing the new foreword.
Oh, okay.
Danny's Reasons is mentioned once in the book. It's one of the bands that Bill Deal worked with frequently. When I said earlier, when I was talking about how, I sort of outlined this book to tell the stories about the bands that had the big hits, and then wherever those conversations led me, those are the other bands that I wrote about. I have to be honest and say that none of those conversations led me to Danny's Reasons. It just didn't come up in my interviews. Now, I was well aware of them. I remember Under My Thumb, which is a single that they recorded and was a pretty good hit here in 1967, I think. They did a nice version of it. I know they were a really popular band at clubs and the bars in the Twin Cities, and they lasted quite a bit longer than some of the bands that I wrote about. And if there were to be, in fact, I spoke to Danny probably about a month ago, and I said if I'd had 40 more pages, I would have written about your band. If there was going to be a second volume, I'd write about your band. It's just, for no better reason than it just didn't come up in conversation. They didn't really have a presence in the book. Well, thank you very much. Enjoy talking about this. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to the second season of the Fireside Podcast, presented by the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. Next week, Minnesota Book Award finalist Beth Dooley discusses her new memoir, In Winter's Kitchen, and shares her journey of coming to know and be an integral part of the Heartland food community. Until then, we hope you consider supporting the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library and its mission, Stronger Libraries for Stronger Communities. Learn more at thefriends.org. Follow us on Twitter at The Friends and on Facebook at facebook.com/friendsofsppl. Please consider subscribing to this podcast on iTunes. Thank you for listening.